Hello again, this is Debbie on Wednesday, October 5th, reading from the e-edition of the Decatur Herald and Review, starting as we always do, part two with the death notices. Starting Macon County, Decatur, Burroughs. Harold E. Burroughs, 85, of Decatur, died Thursday, September 29, 2016, in Heritage Manor Healthcare Center, Mount Zion. A graveside service to celebrate Harold's life will be 11 a.m. Saturday, October 8, 2016, at Lester Barnett's Cemetery. There will be no visitation. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to donor's choice. Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Decatur, Gaffron. Ethel Jane Gaffron, 94, of Bloomington, Illinois, formerly of Decatur, died at 3:30 a.m. on Friday, September 30th, 2016, at McLean County Nursing Home Normal. A private family graveside service will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to a charity of the donor's choice. Interment will be at Graceland Fairlawn Cemetery, Decatur. Calvert and Metzler Memorial Home will have assisted with the arrangements. Peel, Decatur. Billy O. Peel, 88, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 10:55 Sunday, October 2nd, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. A memorial service to celebrate Billy's life will be held 11 a.m. Saturday, October 8th, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion. The family will receive friends for a visitation beginning at 10 a.m. until service time. At the funeral home, memorials may be made to the Mount Zion Christian Church. Messages of condolence may be sent to the website for Dawson Wyckoff. Decatur, Munoz. James Robert Munoz, 80, of Decatur, passed away on Monday, October 3rd, 2016, in his home. Services to celebrate James' life will be 2 p.m. Friday, October 7th, in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 at the funeral home. Private entombment will be in the Star of Hope Mausoleum in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to the Central Christian Church. Decatur, Neil. Vivian Ann Neal, 65, of Decatur, went to be with Jesus Monday, September 26th, with her family by her side. The family would like to give a special thanks to Dr. James Wade. Homecoming services to celebrate Vivian's life will be 11 a.m. Saturday, October 8th, at Kingdom Come Ministries, 3021 East Leafland, with Apostle W.S. Rogers, Jr. officiating. Visitation will be for 1 hour prior to the services at the church. Burial with flight home ceremony will follow in the Resurrection Gardens at Graceland Cemetery. Sullivan, Appleby. Laverne Pauline Guest Appleby, 96, Sullivan, died Saturday, October 1st. Services 10 a.m. Friday, Edwards Funeral Home, Arcola. Visitation 1 hour before services. Burial, Zion Cemetery, Arcola. Arthur Graham. Neil June Graham, 85, of Arthur, Illinois, died at 8:23 a.m. Thursday, September 26, at Silber Family Hospice in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, after a year-long battle with pancreatic and lung cancer. Visitation will be held from 5 to 8 Friday, October 7th, at Schrader Funeral Home. Funeral services will be 10 a.m. Saturday, October 8th, at the Arthur United Methodist Church, with Reverend Bruce Wellman and Reverend Leroy Allison officiating. Burial will follow in the Arthur Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to the Arthur Public Library or the Arthur United Methodist Church. Hillegas Schrader is handling the arrangements. Stewardson, Merriman. Jim Patrick Merriman, 63, of rural Stewardson, passed away 4 p.m. Sunday, October 2nd, at his home. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, October 8th, in St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Strasburg, Illinois, with Reverend Stephen Becker officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 Friday in the church. Burial will be in Grace Cemetery, Strasburg. Awanyaki are handling arrangements. Clinton, Gill. Lisa Chamberlain Gill, 54, a Mountain Home, passed away Sunday, October 2nd, in Mountain Home, Arkansas. Arrangements are private under the direction of Connor Family Funeral Home and Cremation Center. Memorials may be made to the family of Lisa Gill, 1717 Arthur Court, Mountain Home, Arkansas. Connor Family Funeral Home is handling the arrangements. That's the end of the obituaries as printed in the e-edition of the Decatur Herald and Review on Wednesday, October 5th, 2016. On the next page is Dr. Roach, to your good health. Non-medicine treatment for sleep apnea, says the little headline. Dear Dr. Roach, I was diagnosed with sleep apnea several years ago and was put on a CPAP, BiPAP machines and given 1 milligram tablets of clonazepam to help get my sleep started each evening. I've been on this medicine since then. I'm very concerned about the side effects, but was warned via the labeling not to abruptly stop taking it. My present physician has given me an alternative drug, 50 milligrams trazodone, and instructions to gradually reduce my use of the original medicine and substitute the new one. I'd like to get off sleep medicines, period. I also have an issue staying on the machines consistently and have had the pressure reduced, but to no avail. I do not know where to go from here. Dr. Roach says there are two issues here. The first is treatment for the sleep apnea. The CPAP-BiPAP machine is the standard treatment. In many people, weight loss can reduce or eliminate the need for the machine, though it is certainly difficult for many people to lose the amount of weight necessary and keep it off. Alcohol should be avoided by everyone with untreated sleep apnea. For milder cases, oral appliances and singing exercises have been shown to be helpful. A very few people have been treated surgically. None of these may appeal to you or even be appropriate, but I wanted to let you know that there are several options. The second issue is the use of a sedative like clonazepam at bedtime. I agree that this is not a good long-term treatment. It can make the sleep apnea worse, which may be the one reason why you are having a hard time with the machine. Trazodone is a safer medication for most people, but if your goal is getting off medicines entirely, then you should try tapering off the clonazepam over weeks or even months and using non-pharmacological treatments to help you sleep. These include no screen time or bright lights for 2 hours before bed, getting out of bed if you're unable to sleep more than 15 minutes or so, avoiding caffeine after noon, avoiding naps and getting some regular exercise, preferably early in the day. The next question and answer is about low sodium. Dear Dr. Roach, what causes low sodium? What can be done to avoid it? And what are the treatments? Answer. Low sodium is caused by excess water intake or by abnormalities in the kidney's ability to regulate water. Most commonly, I see it as a side effect of medications, especially diuretics used for high blood pressure. However, there are many medications that may cause low sodium. The other major cause is diabetes insipidus, which has nothing to do with sugar and everything to do with water regulation. Symptoms are nonspecific and include fatigue, dizziness, muscle cramps, and nausea. To prevent it, your doctor or other provider needs to be aware of the possibility and must periodically check your sodium level. Treatment is almost always involved restricting the amount of water people take in. And the last question to Dr. Roach is about bird lung. Dr. Roach writes, I recently answered a question about bird lung, discussing two possibilities, an infection, pitocosis, and an allergic reaction, hypersensitivity pneumonitis. A reader wrote in about an infection she had called Mycobacterium avian intracellular complex. Despite its name, it's not caught from birds. It's the most common found in older adults, sometimes with chronic lung disease, or people with suppressed immune systems, especially with HIV. It is treated with multiple antibiotics for a prolonged period. That is the end of the article column by Dr. Roach. The other article on this page by the Tribune News Service writer Kyra Gurney is, the headline says, after losing son, they're determined all students athletes get an EKG. and has a picture of Miami Beach police officers Chris and Chantel Mitchell holding a picture collage of their late son, Dwayne. In March, their son died from a rare heart condition called Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, which could have been detected by an EKG. The parents have created an organization called the Dwayne Have a Heart Foundation to advocate for all children getting an EKG. Miami Beach, Florida. Football season in the Mitchell household used to be a joyous time. The house would buzz with activity and sports talk from September to February as Chris, Chantel, and their son, Dwayne, each donned a different jersey and bet on whose team was going to win. This year, it's quiet. Chris and Chantel lost their 19-year-old son, Dwayne, in March to complications from a heart condition called Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. Dwayne, a healthy, athletic high school senior, suffered sudden cardiac arrest and collapsed at his grandmother's house in May 2007, going into a coma 2 weeks before graduation. Dwayne had played football and basketball since he was 11, and there had never been any indication that something was wrong with his heart. He'd gotten regular physicals, but he had never undergone a simple heart screening known as an electrocardiogram, or EKG, which would have detected his irregular heartbeat. Now the Mitchells are on a mission to make sure other families don't suffer the same heartbreak. Chris, a Miami Beach police detective, and Chantel, a Miami Beach police officer, want the Miami-Dade School District to make EKG screenings a mandatory part of the physical students get to participate in school sports. They are hoping all parents will take their children to get the screening, which is offered for free by Nicklaus Children's Hospital and a few other hospitals around the country. Heart conditions like Wolff-Parkinson-White that can lead to sudden cardiac arrest in children are relatively uncommon. Last year, the heart program at Nicklaus Children's Hospital, which provided the free EKG screening, examined 3,771 children. Only 34 had abnormal EKG results. But children who do not have abnormalities may not experience any symptoms and until it's too late, said John Rhodes, the director of the heart program. That's the end of that article, and the end of D3, well, probably D4. A quick court paragraph. Teen convicted in shooting robbery retrial. This is by Huey Freeman from the H&R staff. Decatur. A-R-K-E-E, Woodson, 17, a Decatur, whose previous trial ended in a mistrial, was convicted by a jury of multiple felony counts Tuesday for shooting a 26-year-old man in the chest during a robbery. Woodson, who sat at the defense table with his attorney, showed no reaction as Circuit Judge Thomas E. Griffith pronounced the jury's verdicts that he was guilty of attempted first-degree murder, armed robbery, and aggravated battery with a firearm. Then finally on this page, victim, Hastert monster protected by abuse law, Chicago AP. A man who said Dennis Hastert sexually abused him decades ago told Illinois lawmakers Tuesday the former U.S. House Speaker was a monster who was protected by the statute of limitations and wasn't appropriately punished. The comment from 54-year-old Scott Cross came as lawmakers are considering joining 37 other states that don't have a statute of limitations for child sexual abuse cases. Hastert was sentenced in April to 15 months in prison for violating banking laws while trying to silence one of four victims identified by prosecutors, but Illinois' statute of limitation meant he couldn't be charged with sexual abuse, which could have sent Hastert to prison for decades. This topic, while difficult for me to discuss, is one that cannot be swept under the rug. His voice shaking at times as he urged a panel of lawmakers to change the limits of current law. Lawmakers have four similar proposals pending that would eliminate Illinois' statute of limitation for sexually abusing children. No votes were taken Tuesday, and the soonest the bills can be considered is next month when lawmakers return to Springfield for a brief session. As it stands, victims of sex abuse have 20 years from their 18th birthday to report the crime so it can be prosecuted. But Cross, who said Hastert abused him when Cross was in high school wrestler and Hastert was a coach, told lawmakers it's difficult for victims to come to terms with their abuse and overcome feelings of guilt and shame before they can tell anyone, a process that can take many years. Skipping to the Decatur Tribune, we have Paul Osborne's City Beat. Macon County's state's attorney's race offers one of the few choices for voters. The general election's in a month away, November 8th, and Macon County voters don't have a lot of choices to make when we cast our ballots. Most of the county races impacting us have the incumbent running with no challenger. For that reason, I'm predicting with complete certainty that Democrat Mary A. Tangi Eaton will be reelected Recorder of Deeds. Democrat Carol A. Reed will be elected County Auditor, and again said with a smile, Republican Michael E. Day will be reelected Coroner. Although Republican Lois A. Durbin is seeking reelection as Circuit Clerk and is being challenged by Democrat Brian E. Brian E. Hott. So far, that race has been fairly quiet with only a month left in the campaign. It's been a lot of years since the name of the circuit court has not been anything other than Durbin or Hott. Kathy Hott held the position for many years until Durbin was elected to the office. The only other Macon County major office contested race is the one that's attracting about all of the attention. That's the state's attorney's race between Democrat incumbent state's attorney Jay Scott and his Republican challenger Daniel L. Hassinger, who lost to Scott in the race 4 years ago. The fireworks in this race were publicly ignited on September 13 when John Davis, attorney for Greg Mattingly, a Republican member of the Macon County Board and chairman of the county's Justice Committee, which oversees the state's attorney's office, asked for a special prosecutor to investigate allegations of misconduct in the state's attorney's office. Mattingly has since stepped down from his chairmanship duties and indicated the request for a special prosecutor was filed as a private citizen. Immediately following the September 13th filing, a flurry of news releases were issued in response to the request by supporters of Scott and Hassinger. Scott and his people claimed the request for a special prosecutor to investigate his contact was politically driven since the election was less than 2 months away when it was filed. Hassinger and his people denied the charge and claimed they had nothing to do with the filing. Then Jim Underwood, chairman of the Macon County Democratic Central Committee, issued a press release stating, on September 13th, two public supporters of Dan Hassinger, a second-time candidate for Macon County State's Attorney, filed a petition requesting the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate the incumbent State's Attorney, Jay Scott. The petition was filed 55 days before the November 8th election with the unmistakable hope and intent that an open investigation would be looming over the incumbent state's attorney on Election Day, an incumbent state's attorney who, should be noted, defeated Hassinger in a landslide victory in 2012. The conduct of these two individuals, Republicans Greg Mattingly and Don Davis, is deplorable. As chairman of the Macon County Democratic Central Committee, I call on the leaders of the Macon County Republican Party to publicly denounce these gutter tactics. Regardless of party affiliation, the citizens of Macon County deserve better. Quote. The day after the request was filed, the Macon County Republican Central Committee issued a press release saying the Macon County Central Committee did not have knowledge of the complaints filed by Mr. Mattingly, the chairman of the Judicial Committee for the Macon County Board. All right, let's start this over here. Chairman of the Macon County Democratic Central Committee, I call on the leaders of the Macon County Republican Party to publicly denounce these gutter tactics. Regardless of party affiliation, the citizens of Macon County deserve better. The day after the request was filed, the Macon County Republican Central Committee issued a press release stating the Macon County Republican Central Committee did not have knowledge of the complaints filed by Mr. Mattingly, the chairman of the Judicial Committee for the Macon County Board. The Central Committee was unaware and had no knowledge of the petition that was filed yesterday in the Macon County Courts until the petition was released on the website of WAND-TV. The Macon County Republican Central Committee does not condone the usage of the judicial system for political purposes. New affidavits from two former employees of the office, Amanda Maxwell Berger and Robin Lewis, were filed last Wednesday and attached to the original filing, which added some fire to the controversy about Scott's alleged misconduct in office. I, Paul Osborne, have not yet sat down with either candidate and talked at length about this race, something I intend to do between now and the election. So my observation is based on some of the reaction I'm getting from our readers and people I talk with on the street. Most of the people I have talked to believe The filing is political because the timing couldn't be worse for Scott. I think the reaction to allegations of Scott using the office for electioneering purposes, using county-owned property for personal use, are drawing less attention than the allegation of providing a computer flash drive that contained pornographic material to a female state's attorney employee, which was then accidentally shown to family members of a crime victim on a computer owned by the county, and the claim that Scott said the flash drive belonged to him. Scott has denied the allegations, but the alleged flash drive incident is the one I'm hearing the most about because it's so easy for people to react to it. Well, not as easy to voters to care as much about as things as electioneering and county offices, etc. Bottom line, the allegations, whether true or false, are not good for Scott, but I'm not sure they'll have a lot of impact on the election. We'll see. Then he says, a different topic, best wishes to Decatur Police Deputy Chief Cody Moore on his retirement from the department after 26 years on the service. We were blessed in this community to have men and women like Deputy Chief Cody Moore protecting us. As we're going to press, Osborne says, we have the announcements made that a $3.9 million gift from Howard G. Buffett Foundation is being made for a new amphitheater at Lakeshore Landing in Nelson Park in partnership with the Decatur Park District and City of Decatur. Buffett will provide $2 million for expansion of the train route at Scoville Zoo to include the Children's Museum of Illinois. Thanks to Howard Buffett, not only for making the generous contribution, but for seeing in Decatur what many of us see and love about this city and its future. It's a very good day. Once again, the Macon County Clerk's Office is looking for Republican voters to serve as election judges for the November 8th general election. Individuals wanting to serve as elected judges should call 424-1305 to sign up, or for more information, 424-1305. A short notice that Beth Mason Creighton has announced she'll run for a seat on the Decatur Board of Education in the April 2017 election. Creighton's among the founders of the Dennis School Millikan Partnership and an active member of the Grow Decatur and City Limitless campaign. There is now a larger article on the donation from the Buffett Foundation. Decatur, October 3rd. Thanks to a $3.9 million gift from the Howard G. Buffett Foundation, a new amphitheater at Lakeshore Landing in Nelson Park will soon be constructed in partnership with the Decatur Park District and City of Decatur. Buffett will also provide $2 million for expansion of the train route at Scoville Zoo to include the Children's Museum. Thanks to another donation from the Howard G. Buffett Foundation, the Scoville Zoo train will be extended to provide for a more scenic ride. The proposed new half-mile loop will expose never-before-seen views of the lake, strengthen the link between Scoville Zoo and the Children's Museum of Illinois, and create a more cohesive operation within Scoville Park. The $1.9 million extension will allow the train to wrap around at the Children's Museum, continuing to connect the area between the museum and the zoo. Riders will be able to board at the Children's Museum and at the zoo. Buffett says he wanted to do the project 20 years ago, but the proposal fell through. We had a proposal put together, but there was one person on the pork board who just didn't want it to happen, and it kind of fell apart, Buffett said. So this has been 20 years that I've wanted to do this. This is great. Mayor Julie Moore Wolf said she's very excited about the project. This was an extra wow and surprise factor to the day. This will be so cool, she said. What a great way for families from all over Central Illinois to spend a day in Decatur. I'm so excited, I can't stand it. Buffett also agreed to buy a new engine to pull passengers. The new locomotive will cost $195,800. It will also replace the current engine Scoville Zoo acquired from the St. Louis Zoo in 1996. Decatur Park District staff will oversee the construction process, which will include track bed preparation, erosion and damage control, site work, bridge and retaining wall construction, and relocation of the parking lot at the Children's Museum. Continuing, for over 35 years, enhancement of the Nelson Park Basin of Lake Decatur has been identified as community priority. In 2012, the comprehensive multi-phase plan entitled Lakeshore Landing, a Community Vision, was unveiled. Family-friendly amenities such as a dog park, disc golf course, boat docks, promenade, and overlook adventure mini golf course have been completed. The Nelson Park Amphitheater is the next major development and truly the linchpin of Lakeshore Landing. The gift from the Howard G. Buffett Foundation represents an increased commitment to the project and to the Decatur community. In 2014, former Governor Pat Quinn announced a $2 million grant for the amphitheater project from the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, which was then matched by a $1.5 million donation from Howard G. Buffett Foundation. When state grants were frozen, however, the project came to a halt until the foundation agreed to replace the state funding with the increased donation. We always believed this project would be a tremendous resource and a worthwhile investment for the Decatur community, said Howard G. Buffett, chairman and CEO of the Howard G. Buffett Foundation. We were disappointed when the state's funding fell through, so we entered into discussions to cover the remaining project costs. With the leadership of the Decatur Park District and City of Decatur, we were able to make this a truly local effort. Located south of Pavilion Number 1 with a spectacular view of Lake Decatur, the amphitheater will be a state-of-the-art cultural arts and recreation venue featuring concerts, arts performances, road races, festivals, and other special events. The facility will draw visitors from across central Illinois and accommodate 300 guests in the fixed seating area adjacent to the stage and an additional 3,000 spectators on the terraced lawn. Included will be a stage with specialized lighting and acoustics, concession building with restrooms, and changing room for performers. Thanks to the generosity of the Howard G. Buffett Foundation, we are continuing to build upon recent successes both as part of the Lakeshore Landing development and throughout the community, said Mayor Julie Moore Wolf. I'm perhaps most excited about the fact that our residents will be able to experience a state-of-the-art facility right here in Decatur, and it will draw people from across the region who will get to see the jewel that is Nelson Park. The Nelson Park Amphitheater will be a great addition to the park system, said Park Board President Bob Breeley II. We've been waiting for a number of years, and thanks to the generosity of Mr. Buffett, our vision is becoming a reality. Construction is slated for April 2017 with an expected completion date of December 2017. The completed amphitheater, made possible by this public-private partnership, will be a unique asset to the Lakeshore Landing development, enhancing tourism and the arts, helping attract and retain a high-quality workforce, and improving the quality of life for all in the greater Decatur community. End of that article. We'll conclude part two with some nation world reports. Hurricane Matthew slams Haiti, aims at U.S. East Coast. Comes from AP out of Haiti. Hurricane Matthew slammed into Haiti's southwestern tip with howling 145-mile-per-hour winds Tuesday, knocking down trees and tearing off roofs in the poor and largely rural area, while inundating neighborhoods in floodwaters and mud. Matthew left the peninsula that runs along the southern coast of Haiti cut off from the rest of the country. A bridge in the flooded town of Petit Gove was destroyed, preventing any road travel to the hard-hit southwest. Local radio said water was shoulder-high in parts of the city of La Caisse. Forecasters said Matthew could be threatening Florida by Thursday night and would likely push its way up the East Coast through the weekend. The forecast triggered a rush by Americans to stock up on food, gasoline, and other emergency supplies. The storm, at one point the most powerful hurricane in the region in nearly a decade, blew ashore around dawn in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, hitting a corner of Haiti where many people live in shacks of wood or concrete blocks. The end of that. And a quick finish report, Yahoo gave NSA FBI email access. AP, Yahoo scanned hundreds of millions of incoming emails at the behest of U.S. intelligence or law enforcement, according to a report published Tuesday. The internet company conducted the surveillance last year after receiving a classified demand from the National Security Agency, or the FBI, Reuters said in its story. The report cited three former Yahoo employees and another unidentified person familiar with the matter. After news of the breach broke last month, Verizon said it intended to act in its own best interest without elaborating. Verizon had no comment on the Reuters report. That is the end of the reading of the e-edition of the Decatur Herald and Review, as well as briefly the Decatur Tribune in Decatur, for Wednesday, October 5th, 2016, read by Debbie. We'll talk to you soon.